Welcome to the Watson Weekly. I'm your host, Rick Watson.
Hi.
Who are you?
I'm not Jessica Lisewski. I am Nick Kaplan in the hot seat today.
It's not the hot seat. This is in your wheelhouse. You have range, my friend.
I have, at least I think I have range.
Right. Incredible range. On today's show, we have a number of super important topics. First of all, H&N joins Nordstrom Marketplace. Second is wedding dresses that are being bought today. Some of them are coming with GLP-1 waivers. This could be a question for the rest of the fashion industry as well. And finally, our mega story of the week is the e-commerce organization of the future. Who, how, and more. Also, did you know that the Watson Weekly has a newsletter? Head on over to watsonweekly.com, hit subscribe.
I subscribe.
It's the best. Yeah, I subscribe too. Come on. What are you waiting for? First up today, H&M joins Nordstrom's marketplaces. You know, if there's one place that I've seen in terms of the up and coming marketplaces, it seems like there's been quite a number of really good ones hit the scene in the last couple of years. And Nordstrom is one, Lowe's is another big one. And H&M, the discount fashion manufacturer, retailer, has hit the scene. This is the first time the Swedish fast fashion giant has listed a product anywhere on an online marketplace in the US. And it's kind of telling that they chose Nordstrom's. What's going on here?
I mean, this is definitely a case of an attempt for 1 + 1 = 3, maybe even 4. Nordstrom is still a really great brand, although with all that physical retail, trying to figure out how to kind of continue to evolve and create revenue. H&M, who would probably cringe if they were listening to this podcast at the word discount. I think they like to think
H&M,
of it.
Don't listen.
I think that they would sort of say that they're more of those, like, the originator of one of fast fashion. But yeah, I think H&M has had their challenges, right? Inventory gluts. And if you're going to be on a marketplace, which is another point of revenue creation and customer acquisition, like, what better place to be than Nordstrom, right? It gives you brand cred. It exposes you to an audience you covet. And I commend both for doing this, although I don't really see, unless they're going to create a whole bunch of exclusive products or collaborations, et cetera, I think it's going to be difficult, but kudos to both.
Yeah. I mean, Kate Rogowski, to your point about introducing yourself to a new audience, she's the head of customer activation and marketing at H&M Americas. She told WWD that they chose Nordstrom because they have a highly engaged customer base and they're fashion forward. And if you look at the price point, it's like typical H&M price point between $20 and $50, or most of them, I imagine most of them are closer to the 20 range than the 50 range.
Yeah.
Just from assortment point of view, they do have a limited edition $400 leather jacket. I'm guessing that's probably not going to move too well.
They probably made like 20.
Yeah, exactly. They haven't committed to a specific revenue, but the US is pulling a lot of weight for H&M right now. This is also, Nordstrom has no inventory commitment. Nordstrom has had sort of like on again, off again brand issues between like deciding if rack was important or not.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the brand fit for a second. Does Nordstrom's lose anything or is it all upside for Nordstrom?
Yeah, I think it's probably all upside. I think that, you know, where Nordstrom is trying to figure out its future is, one, its ability to resell other people's product, two, its own in-house brands that it's created over time and their relevance and value, and three, how can they get more loyalty and a bigger basket? So I see this being a plus one, meaning I'm buying something for my kid, or I'm buying something for myself, and maybe I buy something for my kid from H&M. So yeah, I don't think it's a replace. I think it's an add.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Nordstrom's needs selection. If I've talked to a lot of apparel, lifestyle manufacturers about the Nordstrom marketplaces, I have not heard one bad thing. Like, very strong demand, high volume, engaged customers.
Yeah.
They have a good thing going there, which isn't always the case for a new marketplace.
I think that when you sort of build brand, establish retail distribution and network and then add marketplace, it's a winning formula. To start marketplace or to be single channel only and have marketplace is a disaster.
Yeah. There's so many of those that failed, and that's not the case here. The fact that H&M is coming to Nordstrom is good for Nordstrom. So we give a double thumbs up for H&M and Nordstrom, both on the bold meter here. So we'll see how it develops. And they're going to use this as a test and learn to add other marketplaces. Will we see H&M on other types of marketplaces?
I'm going to say a very strong maybe.
Come on.
I think that even H&M, right, is a global behemoth. A household name has to have some limit to its reach and the diminishing returns it gets. So I am bullish on this endeavor for both. I think that at some point they do more and more collaborative things that are unique to draw off traffic. But I think that Nordstrom also most likely requires H&M to sort of have some level of exclusivity to maintain the strength of the partnership.
Yeah. No, I'm excited to see where this goes. If you're anything like the CEOs and ops leaders I talk to, you're tired of the AI hype cycle. You're ready to move past the prototypes and actually use AI in your daily workflow. This is exactly where Avalara is leaning in. They aren't just giving you a chatbot to answer questions. They've built agentic tax and compliance. Here's why that matters. Most AI just assists you like a sidekick. It gives you more homework. Avalara's AI agents actually do the work. We're talking about AI that lives inside your ERP or your Shopify store to automate the entire lifecycle, from tax calculations and cross-border classification to actually filing the returns and resolving jurisdictional notices. It's about moving from data to decisions in seconds. You can query your tax data in natural language and get back expert-verified answers, not AI hallucinations. If you want to stop messing around with manual compliance and start scaling, you need to see what they're doing with Avi. Go check out the page they set up just for this show. Get the full breakdown at avalaratax.watsonweekly.com. That's avalaratax.watsonweekly.com. Our story too is GLP-1 and its effects on the fashion industry, in particular, brides. New data suggests that 10% of couples that are planning a wedding this year are on GLP-1, and most of them, over half of them, are actually starting it to do it. I mean, look, this has always been a thing. You start your workout weight plan.
I did.
You know, as soon as your wedding starts, and it's planned to peak, you know, a month before the wedding or whatever it is. The problem is, particularly for wedding dresses, tailoring.
And then I got married long before John's. But, you know, you start exercising, you work out, it's a goal.
Yeah.
And it's far more controlled.
It's very motivating.
Very motivating. I think the thing about GLP-1s that people don't realize is the extremity of effect. Mm. I mean, you're not in a situation where you're like gradually losing weight.
Yeah.
You effectively like stop eating and don't really know that you're going to go from like here to like here versus like, here. And so it's definitely interesting and totally logical that a person making a very expensive wedding dress for someone is going to say, listen, buyer, beware. If you come in here and I've spent like 80 hours tailoring, fitting, delivering your product, and you walk in and you've lost an additional two sizes, like, I got to make money. So it's not something where it's like top of mind, but I think it's emblematic of like this entire kind of population shift by these GLP-1s and what it's doing.
I mean, it's interesting. It was some users of GLP-1s lose the clothing site every 2 to 3 weeks. For a wedding dress, that usually has a 6 to 9 month time frame, and there are multiple fittings. I mean, you can't just sort of like, it's not like you're buying clothes off the rack. You know, for a lot of these situations, some of these dresses cost thousands of dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars.
Vera Wang, anybody?
Yeah, hello. A product designer in New York City, fun fact for you, lost 50 pounds on a GLP-1. She picked a gown with a waist size 3 sizes less than her current size.
And
she was made to sign a waiver, which is actually not so atypical because...
I mean, again, yeah, I agree. I get it, but it's also sort of strange, right? I mean, we buy clothes all the time. We get them altered. But I think what it's saying now is like, we've reached this new arena of change and how we react to it. So specifically, am I shocked that someone buys something on the come and that there's some protection for the manufacturer or producer that says, if you don't deliver what you say and I deliver what I say, it's not my responsibility. But I also think that it's probably going to create some opportunities for this kind of really lucrative arena of weddings to evolve further.
Yeah. Evolving the conversation beyond just the wedding industry and going more into the fashion industry. What do you see broadly the effect with your clients, others in GLP-1? You've started your own fashion brand.
In a space that, you know, really, who knows what happens to, we had a really, you know, amazing plus size business that we began in 2004 before it was trendy to be in that business. And it really solved a problem. I mean, there were no, you'd go to a mall and there were no fashionable clothes for this customer who made up 67% of the population. You know, the demography is going to change significantly. So I think that a lot of people talk about opportunity. I don't know. I mean, people are buying new clothes. People are losing weight, feeling better. But it's a total unknown right now as to how it's going to affect the industry. But yeah, it's certainly, it's on everybody's mind. It's not a topic of conversation all the time. But I mean, I wonder, I mean, what do you, you know, we kind of do some things together, some things apart. Yeah, it's like, what do you hear from your world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not really a topic. Most people are just worrying about comping year over year, and they don't talk about anything else.
That's going to be great for our next conversation.
That's the conversation. They're not talking about micro trends in the situation because they have bigger fish to fry. They're worried about too much inventory. They're worried about too little inventory. They're worried about optimizing their marketing spend. What some segments of the population are they going to buy more or the less? Many of them don't understand their customer well enough to get into this sort of motivated why. Like, why do they buy?
In like CPG with those clients, it's a topic. I mean, which is how are people's sort of, you know, I have clients that are in the wellness space as well as the food space, the spirit space. And I think that it's not necessarily about like GLP-1. I think what GLP-1 is showing is, and I read something, I can't remember where I read it, but a brilliant guy like you will maybe remember that like longevity is the fastest growing space. And it's true. So I think what it's more about is like not the cause and effect and like the direct correlation of a GLP-1, but what it overall means to creating food or products like a protein bar. And
I mean, it feels like protein is not having a moment, it's having a decade. Creatine is having a moment.
Yes.
You know, for men in particular, you know, a number of these things are.
So as it relates to this, before we get to the next topic, I'm not surprised. I think that there will be more stories like this that will be on the show about what GLP-1s are doing to change the way that we operate. And this is just sort of a foreshadowing of things to come.
No, I mean, it's exciting to think about how the industry will keep changing. So definitely something that we enjoy talking about. And our final story of the week is the e-commerce organization of the future. I'm super excited about this topic. I know you are too.
Yeah,
this
me
is
too.
Something it feels like we're talking about every day.
All the time.
Every week. Just to catch you up, in case you didn't realize, digital is the operating system of retail now. It's not just a channel. As you reorganize around your digital future, a lot of things changes, but we wanted to talk about a couple items in particular. Number one is like how you plan the business. What does that look like? Second is marketing talent, which feels like how do agencies operate that you work with? What do you need to insource versus outsource? How do those agencies change how they work? Are they being disrupted? Google seems like trying to replace agencies for years and years with their sort of automated buying. Now, Silicon Valley is in on the game, trying to eliminate agencies. Mm-hmm. That's definitely a challenge. And finally, I think one thing is super interesting is like, what's the role of a merchant in this organization? Mm-hmm. Is there a role anymore with ChatGPT, Claude? Are they better merchants than human merchants?
Man, where do we start?
I'm just throwing lots of bombs at you, Nick.
I mean, I think the first thing is to talk about the planning, which I think is so critical. We talk a lot about sort of the inversion of the traditional retail model, which has been happening for a while now, but just accelerating, which is like the measurement of demand to create supply, right? Inventory kills businesses. GMROI, which we often talk about too, is like the most important metric in terms of efficiency, which is, you know, average inventory, gross profit dollars divided by average inventory cost, which is like, you know, what you're putting in and getting out. So we plan businesses by time, and time is dictated by yesterday tradition, which is like a year, a season, a quarter. But like the reality is now we have the ability to
season is 2 weeks.
Exactly. Right. And I think that we're really preaching adoption of a more editorialized world, which I think is where we're heading, which is to say, like, if I was running a business today, I would be like, you know, the Anna Wintour, right? I'd sit at a table every Wednesday. I'd have all my constituents around. I'd have my finance, my planning, and my merchant, and my design, and my ops. And I would build a magazine for 1 year from now, or from 1 month from now, because we have the ability to sort of build content, which creates media, which builds loyalty, which sells inventory, which drives the future org.
I have a strong picture of in my head of Nicky Wintour, Devil Wears Prada 3.
But planning is now about a bottoms-up build. I'm passionate about that. To hear tops-down alone, the two together are healthy. But
there has to be some tension.
Healthy tension
for reality versus goals.
Yeah. So I'd say, number one, planning has changed the sense of what a measure of actionable time is and how we're able to plan more so through the data we're provided to synthesize, which is what AI is actually, in my eyes, for these organizations is a supercomputing and some level of prediction to buy the inventory that we think we need versus what someone, based on data, versus what someone else says we have to have, so that we can optimize that inventory to be left with maybe opportunity cost of missed revenue versus excess and liquidation brand dilution.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of AI, Unilever cut its roster from about 3,000 agencies, obviously a huge conglomerate, to under 800, saving roughly $500 million a year. P&G in-house a lot of their media for about $750 million in fee reductions. You see the digital media agency business, it feels like consolidation is on hyperdrive. And so a lot of these companies, I find, aren't replacing people with machines, but every employee is just becoming that much more productive because they can have much wider and deeper effects from their actions because the tool sets are so much better.
So I think on the agency side, there's two parts to that equation, which is on the brand side, certainly the ability to outsource far more, that there is this growing understanding that having more partners versus employees is a more efficient way to do business. Mm-hmm. On the agency side, the rules of the game are changing almost hourly. You know, PMax is continually evolving, you know, Facebook, ASC as well. And as everyone is building agents, and some of which are really frightening as to their effectiveness and allocation of where spend should be between mediums. And I think that the agency is becoming less a media buyer in terms of marketing and more, if an agency isn't saying to you, let's put it like this, if an agency doesn't say to you, our primary objective is to help you acquire and retain customers, or that's not part of the dialogue, that's not the right agency.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a challenge. And I think agencies are feeling pressure on pricing because, you know, there's a situation where everyone knows AI is making agencies more efficient. So as a result, the client is hoping to reap some of those benefits, not just the agency. So that puts double pressure on the agency to cut costs and or consolidate with other agencies.
I think the other thing too that everyone needs to ask their agency is, what tool are you going to provide me to give me the ability to get insights and take action in partnership with you, because the agency is less a hired gun and more an embedded sort of outside partner.
Yeah. So they need to be an extension of your team that works in concert with you hand in hand.
Yes.
They can make a decision. You can make a decision. Yes. It feels like you're part of the same organization.
Yes. Yes. 100%.
Yeah. Finally, your love language, the merchant. Do merchants survive? What's the role? It seems like assortment planning from a point of view of like editorial, bigger is better has been the name of the game for a long time, particularly in the marketplace era. It feels to me that's changing as the requirements of turn become faster. Mm-hmm. You need to choose fewer assortments, deeper buys, faster turns. Is that the same for everyone or is it different for types of companies?
It's the same for everybody. Obviously, the numbers change. One of my favorite graph of all time is like, you know, it's margin, turn. Mm-hmm. Like you've got Costco here, super low margin. You've got almost brands that don't exist anymore, which is like, you know, Chanel maybe that turns like three or four times and has like a 70% gross margin. But what I'd say is, look, I grew up as a merchant. You know that, right? You know, I love product. I still walk into stores and like touch garments. So the merchant never goes away. Certainly changes. A merchant used to be a really healthy blend of art and science. Mm. And I don't think that that changes, but the sort of percentages, a merchant is a really important, they're the customer, right? The merchant has always been an advocate for the customer, and a brand that creates, design creates that healthy tension we talked about between design and merchandising. A merchant says, this will never be bought by our customer. So someone has to be the customer. So they don't change and go away, but there's less of them.
Yeah, I tend to feel like if you're a technology enabled merchant, then you're a true operator of the business, almost like you own a category of the store on the floor at Saks or something. Like this is your domain.
It's your business.
You don't need four or five other people to help you because you have all the tools, Shopify or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in small businesses, like founder led businesses, of which you know I help. Right, that merchant is the founder, and as the founder evolves into being more of a CEO, there is a merchant, there is a CFO, or other roles that get filled. So it doesn't go away, but the world of like merchant led domination is gone. And we talked about in the five forces of 2025, right? Marketing is king, and that's to say that everybody thinks through that marketing lens, a merchant included,
right? And it feels like in 2026, a merchant is not just editing product, they're editing algorithms. So I think the fight for the future is really about streamlining, flattening. It definitely seems like that's the trend here, how to get cost out so that the company can be as efficient as possible, not necessarily like half as many people, but there's definitely role contraction and people can have broader reach than before. So
100%.
Those are all those things. So we're excited to bring you this show. In the meantime, we'll see you next week. Till then, stay classy, be bold, and see you next time.
Good job, man.
Another great show in the can.